because this is coming on the heels of the preliminary or the first set of verses from the Dhammapada, Manopubhangama Dhamma, that all Dhammas are preceded by the mind. Mano Seta Manomaya, they are governed by the mind, and formed by the mind, actually made by the mind. That all Dhammas, all of reality, if it's going to come about, in reality, it has to come about via the mind. And this is really because of how we look at reality as followers of the Buddha's teaching. But it's not really because the Buddha taught it, it's because of a measured and reasoned acceptance of the Buddha's teaching as being true, that it being a truth that actually what is real is experience. And there's a lot of debate over what is real. I've had arguments about this with people, but what is real? And it's all like the blind man and the elephant talking about things we've never seen. Most of the time, that's what it is. Because you can philosophize and come up with all sorts of ideas about what is reality. And you can come up with all sorts of arguments why something isn't real or why it's impossible to verify whether something is real or not. This whole thing about verification is really quite funny, and we've painted ourselves into a corner in modern science because we can't ever know anything for sure. And it's actually become a boast that the only way to truly verify something is to come close by third person second hand, really, in information through instruments and through impartial experiments. But you can never really know anything. In fact, trying to come to know something directly is scorned upon. Scorned. Frowned upon. Because of the potential for subjectivity. It's not objective to pay heed to one's observations. And there's some measure of truth there, but it's not seeing the forest for the trees, or it's throwing the baby out with the bathwater, or however you want to say it. It's missing something, and it's really throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because you want to get rid of all of these subjective observations, like a person who, in the case of a religious person who sees something or hears something or experiences something and says, this is God, or this is Nirvana, or this is this, or this is that, and gives it some subjective meaning. You want to avoid that. And unfortunately, what people do as a result is disregard it simply because it is a individual perception. They discard it because it was personally observed. And in fact, we normally won't accept in the scientific community. As I understand, they won't accept even if 1,000 or 1,000,000 people had individual observations, but there has to be some way to for a third party to observe what's going on, and the third party has to be controlled and so on in order for it to be acceptable. So you therefore take the whole realm of personal experience out of discussion of what is real, which is quite unfortunate, when really all you have to do is separate subjective experience from objective experience. And it may mean that you can't ever prove to someone else what is reality, but you can certainly prove to yourself what is real. If a person wants to know what is real, if they want to prove to someone else or have it proved to them by someone else's experience, then it's really impossible. Because all it takes is for a person to lie or to misrepresent in some way or other their experience. But if you want to know the truth, for those of us who are seeking the truth, we don't have to use laboratory and rats and experiments experiment subjects in other people and so on. We can use our own experience as long as we understand what is objective experience, and that's really what we do in Buddhism. So it's really actually quite ideal, and it's perfect. That's why I've chosen this path, is because it's really quite clearly the path to understand and to experience reality for what it is objectively. So objective reality, as we should be aware, is experience. So when you see God, or when you hear God, or when you experience the love of God and so on, there's a factual, verifiable part or aspect to that experience, and then there's a subjective, projected, extrapolated part of the experience. And that's the case really with everything. All of our experiences are like this. Our experience right now is made up of the objective portion and the subjective portion. And the objective portion can't ever get you in trouble. It can never be dangerous for you to see or hear or smell or taste or feel or think something. That's the objective part. If someone yells at you or says nasty things to you, if all you understood it to be was a sound or a sight or a thought or so on, and that's how you perceived it. Someone's yelling at you and you perceive it as sound coming to your ear. If you had a pain in the body and you just perceived it as a sensation. If a thought came up, a memory came up, and you just perceived it as a memory, as a thought, just saw it for what it is. If you were really aware of reality, if you're really in tune with things as they were, there'd be no problem. But the real problem is that this is insufficient for the cravings that exist in the mind. Our mind would never go for such a way of life. And this is why meditation is quite difficult, because the mind isn't content to simply live what is really a peaceful and happy life of just being with reality. But the mind has many addictions and cravings and habits that lead it to chase after things that are not really leading to not really in the way of happiness or peace. And it all comes down to our ignorance. We've never really, we've come out of nothing, really. It's not that we've fallen from a pure state into an impure state. We never really had any clue about purity or impurity. These are things that have evolved. These are things that were discovered by the Buddha, that there is such a thing as purity, that there is such a thing as enlightenment. It's something not before understood. by any of us, not ever experienced before by any of us. It's some way of putting together the building blocks of experience in a way that is peaceful, in a way that is complete and harmonious and free from stress and suffering, free from contradiction, really, if you want to get right down to it. Because most of us live in a state of contradiction. We want things to be a certain way, and yet we act in such a way that they don't come out that way. We want to be happy, and we act in such a way that leads to our suffering. So we have this contradiction internally, which is really logically the fallacy of our way of life, or the fallacy of the argument, if it were put as an argument. If we were to argue for this way of life and this path that we've chosen as human beings to chase after sensual pleasures and run away from pains and displeasure, the problem is that it doesn't truly lead us in the direction that we are intending. For us to say that this path leads us to happiness and leads us away from suffering is wrong, is incorrect. Therefore, we have a problem. So Buddhism is merely correcting the argument and correcting our views, really. If you want to put it on a very scientific and objective level, then what we're talking about is removing the contradiction, where we act and we live our lives in such a way where we actually get the expected result, which is peace and happiness. Where good things come to us, the things that that make us happy, the things that bring us peace. And this is what we mean by really ignorance and versus wisdom, because a person who is ignorant, they're unable to see what is to their benefit, and they're unable to see what is to their detriment. And so the Buddha eschews the whole notion of morality, that something could be immoral or unjust or so on. And he does so in a way that I think no one else has ever been able to do to this extent, by saying that actually by being able to have his cake and eat it too, really, where he's able to give up any idea of something being objectively immoral and yet be perfectly moral and show that actually a utilitarian morality is also an absolutist morality, where a person who is acting just in their own best interest is also the perfect humanitarian. This is the beauty, the perfection of what we're practicing here. That's the ideal, isn't it? Because on the one hand, we always have this debate of whether it's better to be objectively moral, even though it's going to make you suffer, or whether you should be morally utilitarian and act for your own best interest and at the risk of hurting others. So which is better? And here we were able to avoid both. That's the ideal. I mean, that would be the ideal in any case, that you would be able to do everything in your own best interest, but never hurt anyone else. And the great thing is that we find that this to be the truth, that when a person acts truly in their own best interest, does things that are truly in their own best interest, then they're helping other people. They wind up helping other people. And when a person helps other people, they wind up, or when a person acts, and at any rate acts appropriately towards other people. Now, maybe that for some people that doesn't mean going out of your way to help them, but it means the not harming and the maintaining of peace and harmony between yourself and the other people and others. This person winds up finding peace and happiness themselves through their harmony. I mean, it's actually quite obvious, and it's something that we should all readily be able to see, especially if we are practicing meditation. But that's really the problem, is people don't practice meditation, and so they come up with all these theories and ideas and so many. This is why the Buddha put such great emphasis on views and the importance of overcoming view, wrong view. Something that the Buddha talks about a lot, really. And we shouldn't ignore that. That really, a big part of what the Buddha was teaching is for us to overcome view, wrong view. And really, he uses these two words interchangeably. Sometimes he says wrong view, but sometimes he just simply says view. And really the point is that anything that is simply a view is wrong. It's wrong to hold views. If it's not a personally experienced reality, then it's not yet adequate. It has no benefit. Well, it can have some benefit, I suppose, but it has no intrinsic value to the mind. It's not going to lead the mind in a positive direction. Not on a moment to moment level. I mean, you can hold views that are in line with reality, and those can benefit you to an extent, but they can't really change the nature of the mind. They can't make us truly good people. We can pretend, and people are able to keep the precepts and pretend to be good people and seem to be very good people and are morally and ethically very good people. But they're at conflict inside, because it's simply an intellectual view. They hold this view that this is wrong and that's wrong, and yet they want to do those things. They have these natural urges to engage in those things. When something unpleasant comes, or an insect or an ant or a creature comes that is unpleasant, the natural urge is to want to hurt and to kill and to harm the other being. And yet they suppress this. So that there's a benefit to that, but it's not an intrinsic benefit where it actually changes the mind, and the mind is actually becomes more at peace with itself. Because the mind is actually in great conflict. And this is what we see in religious circles, not just in the Catholic Church, though that's been a victim, or the Catholic Church has been, not a victim, has been a, well, it's kind of a victim, I guess, it's not quite the right word, but a victim of this bad publicity of these horrible people who became priests, and how the atmosphere of the priesthood has actually become a place that is conducive towards incredibly immoral states of mind and activities. But the Catholic Church isn't the only one, and I'm afraid, really, for Buddhism, because not afraid for Buddhism, but, and it's not even really afraid, it's kind of sad. It's sad to know that in the future there's probably going to be more and more, as Buddhism becomes more and more mainstream. We're already seeing the hints of this, you know, stories of alleged sexual abuses and so on. And the same old cover-ups and the same old ignoring of the facts and so on that you see elsewhere, because it's bad publicity and no one wants bad publicity. But the problem isn't really these bad people. It isn't the individuals. It's the society and it's the structure that holds to good principles. Even you could say that really the Catholic Church is full of good principles. I wouldn't say there's much in the Catholic Church, the institution, that in principle is bad. It's just become lip service instead of actually following the things that Christ told his followers to practice. It becomes all ceremony and ritual and lip service. You know, like we have this ceremony here where we take the precepts. Well, this is people, for most Buddhists nowadays, it's the ritual that's important. They don't ever have a thought of keeping the precepts. I once gave the five precepts to a group of Buddhists in Canada. It was the most shocking experience I've had with a group of Buddhists yet. They invited us for lunch to their house, and they did this quite often. So we would go to different people's houses, and we went to this one people's house, and I think I was the one who gave the precepts. I gave them the five precepts. And then they offered food to the monks, and the monks ate, and it was about a half an hour after we'd given precepts, and they brought out a case of beer and started passing the beer out with the monks sitting there. It was the most shocking thing I'd ever seen as a monk. I ended up seeing a lot more shocking things than that later on, but at that time I was a new monk, and it was quite shocking. I mean, and just think of it, that not that Buddhists should drink alcohol, because most or many of them do it, sadly. But that they should do it during the same occasion that they had just taken these five training rules that were obviously meaningless to them. And with the monks sitting right there who were obviously it was quite incredible. But this is how it's become. It's become just a culture. It's no longer a religion. In fact, religion is really a good thing, because religion is where you stick to the principles. That's what religion means, to bind or to be bound to certain principles, doing certain things and not doing certain things. But when it's just culture, it's just for fun, really. It's just for immediate pleasure and recognition of the familiar. So I'm quite, this is getting off on a tangent a bit, but I can be quite critical of cultural Buddhism. I think it's a mistake. Buddhism shouldn't be cultural, and we shouldn't mix culture and Buddhism. And I think most monasteries out there are aptly named temples. And if you ever hear of something being called a temple, I would avoid it. A Buddhist temple. I'm sorry to say there are many Buddhist temples out there, and I would avoid them. Because Buddhism wasn't made for temples, for praying and making wishes and hoping to get material gain and so on. And when you hear monks being called priests, avoid them. Or try to correct them. They shouldn't be called priests. But I once got a set of monk's robes, and it was in a box for export to America, because they've started exporting them. And it said on the box, Buddhist priest suit. And it was a horrible thing to read, that there should be a Buddhist priest suit. It's kind of abhorrent as a Buddhist monk. Anyway, this is off on a tangent. But it's actually not really the important point here. Is that we are simply paying lip service to these views, and this is in a sense wrong view. In fact, I believe the Buddha said, or someone, if I'm not wrong, it was the Buddha. If I am wrong, it was some great Buddhist commentator or teacher who said that wrong view that is. Wrong view is easier to correct than right view. A view that is a view that is out of line with the truth, such a person who holds such a view is easier to correct, is easier to teach, and is much more likely to gain progress on the path than a person who holds a view that is a view that is in line with the truth. Because when you talk to a person who holds a view that is in line with the truth, it goes in one ear and out the other, really. You can tell them about the dangers of samsara and the dangers of defilements and the dangers of ignorance and unwholesomeness, and they'll just say, yes, 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 I agree, yes, and they'll be able to cite this and that and quote this and that, and everything is so familiar to them. They're like, yes, I know, I know. And it really doesn't affect them at all. You can give talk after talk and they'll just say, sadhu, sadhu, great, great, wonderful, wonderful. But then they go home and they don't practice it. I mean, if you look at these Buddhists, they hold all these views. And then they drink beer in front of the monks. And yet, if you talk to a person who holds a wrong view, and if you just explain to them, and if you're a good teacher, I mean, it's not easy, but it really doesn't, in many cases, it really doesn't take much. If all it is a view, then it doesn't take much. If it's also a clinging and a craving, and it's something that's tied up with their own addictions and their own aversions and their own anger and hatred or so on, then it's quite difficult. But if it's just holding a wrong view, it's actually quite easy to talk them out of it. Because it's out of line with reality. That's the great thing here. We're not trying to convince people to believe something like missionaries of various religions. We're just trying to point out reality. And if their view is in line with reality, then we've got nothing to say about it. But when it's out of line with reality, we can just point that out to them. So it's always fun to talk to people of other religions. It's fun and it's a challenge, really. Because I'm not a Buddha and I'm not perfect. But it can be fun when you're able to show them the contradictions inherent in their stance and their position. The fallacies and the assumptions. And the best way always is to just ask them questions about their view and to help them to examine and explore their own view. You should never attack people's views, but always help them to explore, right? This is objective. This is the best way, and people will respect you for it, and people will be actually willing to change their views. But when you attack people for their views, they will be more than likely to cling to them. Stronger than they did, actually. So the best way to teach people is to help them to explore. And this is what the Buddha did. He would ask people questions. Well, does this and this and this, and is this really leading you to happiness, and so on. And that's really the point. Is it leading us to peace, and is it leading us to happiness? But the only way we can answer this is through objective experience. We can't intellectually answer, because it's so easy to lie to yourself and convince yourself that you're happy. So many people do this. And they're lied to. We're being lied to by society and by our cultures. Being told that this is right and this is sufficient. It's enough for us to be an upstanding moral citizen. The politicians tell you what to do. The movie stars tell you what to do. The novels and the books that we read, our teachers in school tell us what to do. And so we're taught what is right. But the only way we can really come to be right is through seeing it for ourselves. This is what meditation is for. In meditation, we come to observe objectively the reality of our experience. Right here and now, it's all here in front of us. We've got the building blocks all here. We've just contorted them all into some very strange and awkward position that has left us all tied up in knots, really. All we have to do is examine, take a closer look at what we've done, untie the knots, and figure out how the building blocks work, and build only those structures that are conducive towards peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. Or not build constructs at all. Just let it be. But I would say it's not entirely passive, that our practice should be interactive. We should act when it's appropriate to act, speak when it's appropriate to speak, do when it's, think what's appropriate to think. Have a behavior that is appropriate. I think appropriate is the best word to use. Shouldn't say right or so on. I shouldn't say acting purposefully or so on, intending to do lots of good deeds. A person shouldn't really have intentions per se. They should just act appropriately. They shouldn't intend for certain consequences, expecting or hoping or wishing. They should only act appropriately. And this comes with understanding. When you understand how things work, everything falls apart, all of our constructs and our knots. They all become untied and untangled, and everything flows smoothly and naturally. The way it goes according to its, like the laws of gravity, it just goes, flows and flows. So this is all just talk, but hopefully it does clear up some things. I know for most of you these things are fairly clear already. The most important is for us to just keep practicing, but it's always good to be reminded of these things because it alerts us to the reality that is ever-present all around us and reminds us of what's going on. It reminds us to pay attention. And this is really what we're doing here, is reminding ourselves to pay attention. So that's, I think, enough talk for now. Now we can continue on with maybe 15 minutes of meditation, and then we'll quit for the day. So I'm going to turn the audio off.